I'm going to begin with some introductory comments and then talk about some challenges facing the sources of food supply, talk about some problems impacting food supply, and then talk about what is in some circles sort of a holy grail, and that is the prospects for biotechnology and what biotechnology could do for bolstering food production and the nutritional content of the foods we eat. So I'll close by talking about that. I've been in Washington, D.C. about a half a dozen times between the beginning of the year and up till now for various meetings associated with this task force that I've been on. And while I was there, I just happened to pick up the Washington Post, and this was this was a graphic on an article, I think on page one, and I think this was January or maybe February 28th or so. This is a CIA study. Some of you may not trust the CIA at all. Others of you may feel this lends more credence to it. But the bottom line is that the CIA pooled together intelligence information from all of the various U.S. intelligence services and came to the conclusion that during 1995, the year that we are in, 39 million people around the world face the prospect of death from starvation. Let me make sure I have this exactly right. Starvation or disease in the year 1995. And you can see lots of countries there that you would expect to see, and perhaps some others that you wouldn't. Tanzania, Pakistan, but others that certainly aren't surprises. Haiti, Liberia, Sudan, but notice Bosnia up there. This was also issued before the crisis broke out in the former Russian, or the Russian Republic of Chechnya. So 39 million folks is a lot of people. That in this year, and maybe not in this year, maybe it'll begin in 1996, may face death from starvation or disease. Natural disasters like famines or floods or earthquakes will only claim some of these people. Many more will suffer the dangers of malnutrition and disease as a result of ethnic conflict and civil war. So when we talk about hunger in the world, we have to be sure that we understand that it's not only the lack of food, but it's a variety of social and economic and political circumstances that lead to a disruption in the food supply and in food production. All right, let me pull that one off for a minute. Also, for those of you that weren't here yesterday, let me just quickly put this one up on the screen. This is the United Nations medium variant projection, which is the one that the international community is operating with as the most likely projection of population growth in the near future. Is that fuzzy or clear enough? Do I need to adjust this? It's okay. This goes to the year 2050. It actually, the medium variant projection extends to the year 2150 and says that in the year 2150, the world's population will stabilize around 11.6 billion people. But between now and the year 2050, 55 years from now, the world will reach 10 billion people if we sort of operate at the status quo in terms of what we're doing to address population growth issues. So I put this up there. If you weren't here yesterday, this is an important statistic. It shows us that within the next 20 or 30 to 50 years, we're going to have close to twice as many mouths to feed. And the reality is that 95% of all future population growth will be in the nations of the developing world. So those nations are the nations that right now, in many cases, struggle to feed their populations. So this is a very sobering kind of statistic, a very sobering kind of reality, or projected reality, to think about. In February of this year, the United Nations convened a meeting of food experts in Geneva. to reflect on precisely this question. What is the prospect for food supply in the over the course of the next few decades? And the meeting concluded positively. The scientists and experts believed that there will be sufficient food to feed another 2 billion people. We'll add about 1 billion people per decade for the next 2 or 3 or 4 decades. Maybe 5 decades probably. And at least for the next 2 decades, these experts concluded that there is going to be enough food in the world to feed all of them. Now, of course, whether that food gets to the folks who need it is, of course, a separate question, which they weren't asked to answer. They were simply asked, will there be sufficient food? So let me talk a little bit about sufficiency in terms of food availability. There are 2 studies of which I am aware, and I'm sure there are many others, but these are the 2 that I've become aware of. One is a 1990 Brown University study. They have the Alan Sean Feinstein program on world hunger there, which is funded by the U.S. government through a grant, endowed grant sort of thing. And then a 1995 study issued this year by a group called the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C., New York. How many of you have heard of World Watch? They publish the State of the World report every year and several. I think they have a fairly decent reputation. And certainly in environmental issues, they have a very, very good reputation. Okay, what are the conclusions of these studies? I don't get intimidated by these overheads. When I lecture to a large group in Decorah, I use these because they have to take notes. So don't get intimidated, but it's a helpful way to sort of present the information for you. I don't know, can you read that? Okay. The 1990 Brown University study looked at food supply availabilities in 1990 and said if all of the world's food was equitably distributed to the, at that time, about 5.3 billion people in the world, and distributed on a vegetarian basis, in other words, no meat in the diet at all, then the Brown University study concluded that we would be able, as a world, to feed 6 billion people. That's based on 1990 food production levels. If we were to try to feed people on the basis of a Latin American diet, which derives 15% of its calories from animal sources, then we could sustain about 4 billion people. And if we tried to sustain people on a diet like the United States, which derives approximately 30% of its calories from animal sources, we could feed about 2 billion people. Well, that's one reason why Holton Village serves meat about once a week. I'll talk a little bit more about this later. Eating lower on the food chain is at least an act of solidarity and a gesture, a symbolic attempt to share the world's grain with others. I'll talk more about that later. The World Watch Study Institute was generated this year by Lester Brown and Hal Kane. And the Institute, and instead of looking at 1990 levels or 1995 production levels, they looked at rates of annual increase in production, which, you know, are pretty clear. We know what past rates have been in terms of increases, and have then figured out what projected what grain production will be in the year 2030. So on the basis of grain production in the year 2030, these are the numbers of people which they feel the world could reasonably sustain. On a U.S. consumption level of 800 kilograms of grain per day, we could sustain 2.5 billion. Italy's consumption level of about 400, about half of the U.S. level of grain, could support 5 billion. And at the Indian consumption rate of 200 kilograms, we could support 10 billion people a day. Remember what I said, the year 2050, the world is estimated to reach 10 billion people in the year 2050. They're saying that in the year 2030, we could feed 10 billion people. What do you make of those kinds of statistics? It's hard to know if, you know, they're right. These are both fairly reputable organizations. The meeting of experts in Geneva certainly expressed significant concern about future food production, but they did feel, like World Watch, that there would be sufficient food to feed everybody. They didn't say at what level, what kind of dietary level, and they didn't address the issues of distribution. Right now, the problem the world faces in terms of food for the people of the world is distribution, not production. The problem we face right now is distribution. I'll come back to that in a minute. One of the realities is that because of the more meat-intensive diet of the United States and other industrialized nations, and the United States isn't the only meat-intensive nation, the fact is that there's a global grain consumption ratio of about 4 to 1. I guess I didn't put that on. That is to say, per capita, citizens of wealthy developed nations consume about 4 times more grain than citizens of poor developing nations. Why? Well, because 37 to 40% of the world's grain is fed to animals. 37 to 40% of the world's grain is fed to animals, and that amount is increasing as not only industrial. Actually, the United States has decreased its rate of beef consumption per capita, but we still have a slight population growth rate. So our actual absolute amount of meat consumption has gone up. Or beef consumption. And just to give you an illustration, in the European Union, 57% of its grain is fed to animals. In Brazil, 55%. In Taiwan, 62%. In Mexico, 31%. Now, I was in Cairo last September. I think the figure there is like Mexico's 30 to 40% of its grain is fed to animals. But who can eat the meat? Those who can afford to buy it.
What is our rate in?
You know, I don't know why I didn't include this. Oh. I didn't put it down here. I can tell you that the U.S. leads the world in the consumption of meat per capita with 115 kilograms in comparison to India, that on a per capita basis consumes 1 kilogram per person. So it's just a sense of how wide the discrepancy is. And so vegetarianism is not only an issue, you know, for PETA, what's the acronym stand for, people for the ethical treatment of animals, who are concerned about the way we slaughter creatures to feed ourselves. And that is a legitimate moral issue. But what I'm trying to say is that vegetarianism, or at least reflection on vegetarianism, is a legitimate social justice question. Is it legitimate for me to eat a hamburger in the airport while I'm waiting to you know, catch a plane? Or to do that frequently? To eat so high on the food chain on a regular basis, when I know now that when that grain is fed to an animal, if it were instead somehow fed to human beings, that we could feed a lot more human beings than what we could with simply the amount of grain we feed to animals. This is just an overhead that shows you beef consumption per capita. Unfortunately, I don't have one that shows. This is per capita. I wish I had one that showed total production. And you can see the red line is industrialized nations. There's been a slight drop in the mid-80s, but you can see that countries with economies in transition, that's a phrase primarily reserved for nations in the former Soviet Union, you know, meat consumption is going up. And this green line is, you can see a very gentle and gradual increase upward in meat consumption. You can also see how far it is from the others. But because so much of the world's population lives in developing nations, the actual amount of meat consumption in those in the developing world is going up at a very rapid rate for those who can afford to buy it or raise it. And I'll get to that in just a minute. One of the major realities then of food production around the world is the consolidation of production in agribusinesses. According to World Watch, about six companies control 85% of the world's grain trade. Cargill, I think, may be the world's biggest. Three meat packers in the U.S. slaughter 80% of beef in the country. And half of U.S. grain is grown on only 4% of our farms. My brother works for John Deere, and they are constantly researching family farms or farming in the United States. I mean, their livelihood depends on it. And my brother says that within about a decade, we now have less than 2 million farms in the United States, and within a decade we'll have less than a million. So, on the other hand, we're producing gigantic amounts of food. What's that?
How many do we have now?
It's under 2 million now, and in about a decade it'll be under a million. We've been losing about 100,000 farms a year.
To what?
Consolidation, economic inefficiencies of small-scale production as efficiency is measured in standard economic terms.
But the land's still being farmed. It's not being given over to housing or something like that.
Actually, I want to talk about that. And some of it is. Some of it is being encroached by urban sprawl and industrial development.
My family farms both in North Dakota wheat and in Palouse Empire in Idaho. And most of it is the families that age, they just lease their land to others, and it gets consolidated by everybody in a group leasing to one guy that has the efficient tractors and so forth. But they still own the land, and they're still considered like farmers, but they just lease it out.
That's true.
But the land's still being farmed.
Yes, and it's still owned by the original people, most of it. It's just leased. Yeah. A lot of it's just leased.
So if they want to go back into farming,
they could do it again.
You're absolutely right. There's a legal incorporation of family farms, but there also is a large growth in sort of standard corporate farming is the only way that I can really describe it. So let me move on from there. Philip Morris is the world's largest consumer products corporation. In 1990, it had gross sales of $44 billion. That exceeded the GNP of Israel, Portugal, and the Philippines put together. So all I'm saying is that food supply, food production in the world is increasingly being consolidated into the hands of agribusiness corporations. And they are very large and very powerful corporations. One of the aspects of the history of Central America, at least the modern history of Central America, is the power of large US-based fruit and vegetable companies, Dole, United Brands, and the power that they have exerted in those nations to control land, to control labor, and to control internal politics. That isn't going to decrease. That's all I'm saying, is that the power of agribusinesses in the future is not going to decrease. And then the other thing we need to recognize is that the distribution of food in the world is done on the basis of one's ability to pay for it, or on the basis of one's ability to grow it. I'll say a little bit more later about cash cropping and the fact that so much land is devoted to raising beef for us in Central or Latin America, or coffee, which I probably couldn't live without, chocolate, which I probably couldn't live without. But the fact is that the distribution of food in the world is based primarily on the basis of one's ability to pay or to grow the food. if you don't have access to land to grow your own food, you have to buy it or trade for it. When 1 to 2 billion people in the world live in abject poverty, according to the World Bank, makes it hard to buy the food you need to survive. I was reading an article recently in a publication that said they couldn't understand why food production was a criterion for sustainable development, or for someone wondering about the sustainability of a society. And the person pointed to the United States and said, look, there is food, there is abundance of food. It's all around you. But of course, what they don't add is, that's true, but you have to have the money in your back pocket to buy it, right? That is definitely the case for everyone else in the world, and the more poor you are, the less you have to buy. Some of us have the impression that the United States gives away a gigantic amount of food, and perhaps it is gigantic if we think about it in certain ways. But the fact is, it's not very much. The international community only gives away about 1% of the world's grain harvest through free humanitarian aid. Only 1% of the world's grain harvest is distributed in that way. And frankly, that's not always very good either. Jonathan could probably tell us all sorts of good stories of how the United States has dumped free food in Ethiopia or the Sudan and destroyed a local agricultural economy. On the other hand, you could probably point to several examples where that food meant life or death for a group of people. And so it's certainly necessary and needed. What you may not know is that in May or June of this year, I can't remember the exact date, the Clinton administration decided to cut in half the amount of food the United States will contribute to the Food and Agriculture Organization's Emergency Food Fund. Now, I mean, I don't know about you, but when your own CIA says there are 39 million people facing the threat of starvation or disease, death from starvation or disease, that seems to me to be an incongruous act, especially coupled with the kind of decisions in Congress lately to cut development assistance by 25 to 35%. So some of us Americans, I think, need to disillusion ourselves of the notion that we give away a lot of our food. We don't. At most, 1% of it is given away, and it appears that may be reduced. In the future, the problem isn't going to be just distribution. The problem is also going to be production. If we have 10 billion people in the world, basically a doubling by the middle of the next century, we're going to need a lot more food to feed them. And simply distributing the amount we have now won't be enough. We're going to need to produce more. The problem, according to the World Watch Institute, is that since 1984, global grain production, now grain isn't the only thing you can feed people with, and I'll talk in a minute about other sources of food supply. Since 84, global grain production has only been growing at a rate of about 1%, while global population growth has been growing at 1.75%. The historic history here is that since 1950, global grain production increased on average by 3%, while global population growth was between 2 and 1.7%. It's been declining from 2.1 to 1.7%. So the bottom line is, global grain production per year has been keeping pace and producing more than the percent of increase in population. Now it's the opposite. Those lines have crossed. Population growth is now larger than the annual increase in grain production. You extend that out for a long period of time, and it's already true for a decade, doesn't bode well for the kinds of production that we're going to need in the near future. We're going to have less food, larger populations, probably reduced consumption for many people, and increased cost of food as supply diminishes and demand increases. What happens to price? Price goes up. That's law of supply and demand. So, and more nations are going to have to import food to feed their populations. Okay, I want to talk now about food systems, but before I do that, why don't I stop and just see if there are things you want to ask about, things you want to add, Bob?
How are these statistics, how do they come up with these kind of statistics? Who, I can think of Central American countries, all the peasants that are growing corn and beans. I don't know of anyone that goes out and does studies to find out how much is being produced.
Well, actually, I think you'd find that, you're right. It's hard to know what each campesino is growing in each little corner of Honduras. On the other hand, the Food and Agriculture Organization has been around now for several decades. And the World Watch stuff is all based on UN, on FAO studies. And those studies are normally based on analyses done in countries by people who are trained in these fields. I'm sure there's no doubt that there's probably great variation in terms of the quality of the information from different countries. Obviously, Honduras has far fewer financial resources to study the economic and agricultural life of its nation in contrast to Canada or the United States. But taken together, the analysts believe that the data gives a reasonably accurate.
We come from market data. The grain that reaches the market, so their data could be easily gathered.
Sure.
I'm curious as to how we are able to increase the grain production by 1% of the year. What's happening to
through I'll talk about that in a minute, but it has been primarily by putting more land into production and by increased yield from the plants that are in the field.
Can I make a comment? Because I've testified from the Congress and the presidential committees on this, and what the difference is that I demonstrated several times is that we're a meter society. We're meter for everything, like gas in our car, the exhaust, and the electricity, and they know everything about Americans.
Mm-hmm.
You go to these foreign countries, they know very little, and they barter most of their food for other things, so they don't have taxes. There's a lot of bartering internationally. Mm-hmm. They don't allow us to do that. We don't report anything for the IRS purposes and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That's all changing rapidly.
Yes.
Because EDS, Ross Perot's old company, took over tax collection for all of Europe and UK, Canada, Australia just 6.5 months ago. Through General Motors owns that now, and they're straightening that out so they have accurate information.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll be more metered like us, and instead of bartering for it, they'll have to document what they did for their crops, and they'll have more accurate data. But basically, all the data that they've accumulated in the past and has neglected the bartering aspect.
And subsistence level farming.
Yeah. And
yeah, sure.
But to grow that grain, you've got to own land.
Right.
And a lot of people, but they could also notice that there are more people going to
Mexico City.
Into the town.
Right.
I mean, and they don't have access to land.
Right. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Yep.
Since poultry also eats grain, how does the, quote, I don't know what other term to use other than efficiency,
exactly the term.
Yeah. Is poultry raising more efficient, less efficient?
Much more efficient. Actually, if you're going to feed grain to something,
mm-hmm.
The fish is probably the most efficient, then poultry, then pork or mutton, I think, mm-hmm. Before pork, and then pork and then beef. Mm-hmm. I'd have to look at the data. I think it's like, I hate to hazard a guess, but the difference between fish and beef is about 5 times greater efficiency.
It's 1 to 2 for chickens, 1 to 4 for pigs, 1 to 10 for pigs.
There we go. That's what I thought.
So beef are way down the list.
Yeah, so chickens are better.
Chickens are 5 times better than beef.
There you go.
That's what I have in my head.
Yep. No, that's connecting with what I had, but I didn't want to throw numbers out that I wasn't sure about.
Then figuring the numbers of people that are fed by, that's included.
No, 2 pounds of grain will produce 1 pound of chicken meat.
Right.
Okay.
But 10 pounds of grain only produce 1 pound of beef.
Okay. so that is the same comparison.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is Jonathan Ferricks. Yeah. Well, for the rest of you that may not know him, Jonathan is the media director for Lutheran World Relief.
I'm just checking and seeing if Jim is telling the truth.
He's sitting right in the center. No, he's a good guy. Well, more comments, or should I? Can I move on? I'm a little nervous about time.
Move on.
Move on. Okay. All right. Food supply. First, talking about food systems. Three primary food systems: oceans, rangelands, and crops. And you know, we're talking thumbnail stuff here, so don't do it. This is one very solid reality. Global fish catches have declined since the 80s. Here's a graphic to show you that. James Baker, the head of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric, whatever it is, department in... I'm sorry?
Administration.
Yeah, there you go. NOAA was a member of my task force, and so this particular data I know to be good and solid because he's quite concerned. You can see that just about 1989, since 1989, annual marine catches have really dropped, and you can see they were growing for many years. Whether this is a short-term, you know, aberration that will simply turn up again, everyone hopes is the case, but there's good reason to worry that it is not. The speculation is that this decline, well, it's not entirely speculation, but the leading causes for this kind of decline are laid at the feet of overfishing and pollution, with the greatest hopes for marine contributions to food supply being in greater efficiency of fishing. They estimate that 15% more fish could be brought to market if they simply were more careful or invested in the machinery that would more efficiently recoup the the usable portion of the fish to sell at market. And then aquaculture, catfish farms are all over the Midwest. I don't know if they have trout farms out here. But that's increasing not only in the United States, but of course around the world. Aquaculture, there are some major problems associated with that when you get a lot of creatures in one small area, but there are ways to mitigate that, and you don't have to go gigantic in scale to accomplish significant financial results. So there is some hope for providing increased production in terms of world food supply through aquaculture. But on the other hand, we can see this decline, at least from our oceans, and that's cause for concern. About half the world's population lives on a coast, and that amount is increasing every day. In terms of rangelands, 20% of the world's land supports 3.2 billion animals. It's an interesting statistic. The number of the population growth rate among animals is, or domesticated animals, is greater than it is among human beings, which says something about the desire to, in most economies, to bring meat to the table, because it's those creatures, those animals, that are later converted into a meat supply. So about 20% of the world's rangeland or land is rangeland that supports 3.2 billion animals. Beef and mutton production is declining. Part of that is because of the health concerns in industrialized nations over the consumption of red meat. In some cases, it's because of the cost. Pork and poultry production is increasing, as pork is the other white meat. Then the need for fodder to feed these animals. I said 37 to 40% of all grain is fed to animals. The need for fodder exceeds supply in many developing nations right now. So, can we put more animals on the land to raise the food that we need? Well, maybe, maybe not. I'll talk about some environmental problems in this third section. Turning and just looking quickly at crops, Roger, you asked, you know, how did we accomplish this increase, this 3% annual increase up to 1984? It was by converting land into cropland, marginal land into cropland through irrigation or simply planting in marginal land, and through the increased yields that came through the Green Revolution. Some of you probably know about that term, huge gains there. But right now, much of the world's cultivable land is in production. This is not a new problem. They have to feed the world. So there frankly isn't a lot of new crop land, you know, new land to put into to crops. Some folks have the impression that the various set-aside programs in the United States and in Europe could, in a last-ditch effort, be put into production, but they only represent 1.6% of the world's cropland. Now, it's 1.6% of the world's probably most fertile cropland, most productive cropland, so it will produce much more than a 1.6% increase in food supply. But then, what does that mean long-term in terms of what happens to the soil and land degradation, soil erosion, etc.? So, we certainly could put more land in the United States into food production, but if we put it all in, it may bode ill in the long run in terms of sustainability. War and civil unrest reduced crop production. That's why I talked about that 39 million folks around the world. Not all of them are going to be the victims of earthquakes or famines or other natural disasters. Probably the majority of them are going to be the victims of war and ethnic conflict, which forced them to flee their lands. I mean, think of what Saddam Hussein did by emptying those oil, taking the caps off the oil fields and plowing all that oil into the Gulf, destroyed marine life. Latest I've heard is that it's coming back, but for a while it certainly destroyed it. And in other places, the slash and burn, or burn and what's that phrase?
Slash and burn.
Well, slash and burn is a type of agriculture, actually. What's the Vietnam
scorch and
yeah. Well, you know what I mean. I mean, there are some wars that are fought that way. Destroy the economic viability of your opponent, and that means destroying the agricultural base. And urban sprawl, someone asked about that, is claiming a lot of cropland every day. I've heard that statistic, but it doesn't jump off the top of my head. But it's significant. Urban freshwater needs are putting some irrigated acreage out of production. We're going to see more of that in the western parts of the United States as major metropolitan areas in the arid regions of the west and southwest. I mean, human beings need water to survive. And as the demand increases, we'll see an increasing diversion away from agricultural use, which is profligate and grossly wasted in the United States, to domestic consumption. But that means that water isn't going into agricultural irrigation, although there are probably ways to do that much more efficiently than we do now. And then cash cropping, this is the huge one. Bob and I were talking about this yesterday. A vast amount of the world's cropland is devoted to growing cash crops, which nations sell on the world market to get the dollars they need to buy oil, to pay the debts that they owe the United States and other Western nations, to buy the luxury goods that their elites like to purchase, their Sony televisions, Cadillacs. I don't know why you'd want a Cadillac, frankly, but some people do. And the bottom line is, a lot of the world's best agricultural land is used to grow food for export, not food for domestic consumption. And a lot of the people who face malnutrition in the world live in precisely those nations, where the land is concentrated into the hands of a few, and the crops that are grown on that land are not available to them, because they can't afford them, and plus how much coffee can you consume, or how many bananas can you eat. And certainly that land, if put into domestic or subsistence agriculture or local agriculture, perhaps could feed the local populations better. That's a very complex reality, however. But the bottom line is, cash cropping makes a big difference in terms of the quality of life and availability of food supply.
Can you quantify those?
The amount of cropland?
You know, A through F. A is a plus what percent, and B is a...
Well, I gave you some 1.6% on national set-aside programs. I can say that the amount of new cropland that could go into production each year would not exceed, I don't think, more than between 1 and 5%. War and civil unrest, and of course, always varies in terms of which wars. How many wars are raging on the planet right now?
60 or something.
Yeah, well, I've heard a number of half that, but it's still quite a few. So that's not inside.
You know, just to get some sense of what is the total cropland potentially available.
I can show
and
you
what
this graph.
Each of those might be.
Yeah, let me show you this graph. This may help you. I don't know. This is another World Watch graph, cropland per capita in regions of the world. This will help show the impact of population growth. Basically everywhere it's a decline. Population per cropland per capita is declining. And when that happens, you need increased yield to match demand. That's going to be the rub in the near future. I'm just going to talk about that in just a second. Can I go on or?
Sure.
Does that graph help? I'm not sure I could answer it according to A through F and give you a firm.
Okay.
Isn't it also too that there's a lack of diversity of crops that we're concentrating?
Monoculture.
Yeah.
There are about 100 genetic strains which provide the basis for the world's food supply. And so far, to no significant avail or a jeopardy, but certainly a major infestation of some kind of new bug that we don't have an insecticide for or pesticide for. And if it attacked the U.S. corn production, it would make a huge impact on world food supply.
And the diversity of our food supply is too that we could get other nutrients in a different crop, but we're cutting down on, we only like potatoes and meat.
This is one of the arguments for concern about the loss of biological and genetic diversity, that it's critical that we not lose important species, because when the parasite emerges that destroys the 10 most basic food producing crops, we're going to need substitutes, and better to have a larger storehouse of alternatives than a small.
Are any efforts being made to work with the people of the former Soviet Union, say Georgia and the Ukraine, to teach them how to farm so their productivity rate is as productive per acre as ours is?
I honestly don't know very much about those economies and transition in the former Soviet Union. I know that they are certainly predisposed to the kinds of industrialized agriculture that we use here in the United States. But one of the problems with that kind of agriculture is that it's very energy intensive and very cost intensive. You need the petroleum, often petroleum-based fertilizers, and the right mix with water. And if you don't have the water and you don't have the money to buy fertilizer, you may not get the kind of yield that we've been getting here. So, on the other hand, there's probably great potential for improvement in production there, but those financial barriers need to be...
It's an education for them.
Yes.
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 Just recently I read the newspapers about that in India, and it's probably not just India, that the loss through their actual loss of grain is like 30 to 40%. And this is dealing with, mostly in India, it's dealing with rats.
Right, right.
That consume astronomical amounts of the potential supply they need to feed the people.
That's right.
They don't seem to have any way of controlling this rampant, and I'm sure that it isn't just India that has this problem, but the article I read was on it, and that amazed me. It was 30 to 40% of their grain production is consumed by
vermin.
By rodents.
Yeah, yeah, no, I've heard that statistic as well. I can only assume that Indians are reasonable people like the rest of us who would prefer not to have that be the reality. My guess is that the impediment is the financial obstacle of erecting the kinds of storehouses that we have here and the systems of storing that kind of food. And it's a poor country, and it's getting poorer every day. So I think that's another moral issue for nations like the United States and Christians for us to wrestle with is, how can we help our brothers and sisters who are obviously generating significant amounts of food be more efficient in their production, storage, distribution? And often what is lacking, often, not always, but sometimes it's knowledge. Sometimes it's technique, machinery, but often it's money. And that, it seems to me, is what the United States has the most of. Many of you probably don't feel like you're rich, but in the eyes of the world, you are very rich. Yes?
One thing about the conservation of soil, you're talking about all the stuff you mix in to make a good crop. Well, soil conservation may in fact be the element that's preventing the ocean from producing what it used to in abundance. And there's an example of this down in Antarctica. They had some rusting ships that they sunk after World War II that produced major shrimp and all these different things that grow down that cold water. And it was just the element of iron that allowed that to occur. As soon as those ships rusted out, they lost that. They couldn't figure out why it suddenly went dead again. They just started dumping all the different chemicals in the water until they figured it out. They analyzed the soil, basically, and at 5 or 6 they put in there. And they seed it now. And it's an amazing amount of production. And they feel that possibly along our coastlines where we've had, you know, power electric dams and soil conservation, used to have mining, open, you know, mining areas where it just ran into the rivers. That may not be good for salmon or something, but as, in terms of sea life in general, it's better to have those minerals circling through the water. So there's things where the ecologists can adjust to the needs of some of those. That's what they're trying to study out right now, is where that balance is. A lot of things haven't been balanced out. So, anyway.
It's 7:08. Should I keep going, or do you want to just stop and keep talking? I've got a little bit more. I've got a lot more, actually, to talk about in terms of problems impacting supply and then biotech, but we probably won't have enough time to get to biotech. But let me get through the problems impacting supply, and then see where we are, at least. First, just in terms of water scarcity, you need water to grow crops. The land under irrigation has doubled since 1950, with most of that land being in China and India, which is good because that's where population growth has been the greatest over the last 40 years. Much of this increased production has been accomplished through the diversion of surface waters and the drawdown of aquifers. The problem is that, at least in terms of the drawdown of aquifers, our rate of mining of those aquifers is greater than the natural rate of regeneration or replenishment of the aquifers. So that, for example, the Ogallala Aquifer in the central or west central region, south central west region of the United States, basically under Nebraska and portions of Texas, etc. The estimates are that we're pumping water out from the aquifer at about a third faster than the aquifer can naturally regenerate or replenish itself. It's a gigantic amount of water. It's a lake greater, I think, in volume than the Great Lakes combined. But there are some portions where the aquifer is quite shallow that now ground is settling and pumps, wells can't be drilled deep. Well, they can be drilled deep enough to reach it, but it's quite cost prohibitive to do that. Right now, it's not a crisis, but in the long run, it's going to become an increasingly costly endeavor. That cost may be recovered through more efficient irrigation methods, which will require a smaller supply of irrigation water. But there is a fixed amount of water. And so, for example, in China, there are 300 cities that are short of water, with 100, including Beijing, being chronically short of water for all purposes, irrigation, industry, or domestic consumption. So the problem of water scarcity is going to become, in many respects, one of the issues of the next century. Efficiency, as I said, is going to be our best bet for increased supply from fresh water. Less than 2% of the world's water supply is fresh water. The rest is salt water in the oceans. And of that 2%, less than 1% is available, because that other more than 1% is locked up in the ice caps. Fertilizer fall off, problems impacting supply, is that fertilizer has been key for the last 40 years. Much of this is petroleum-based fertilizers. Used properly with the right amount of irrigation has produced a significant amount of food. And new crop strains have been either conventionally created through a hybridization process or genetically created in the laboratory to make maximum efficient use of the inputs of water and fertilizer together with the host soil. The problem is that right now crop gains produced by fertilizer use have declined. Crop yields are not increasing. They are still increasing, but they're not increasing at the significant rates that they increased during the Green Revolution, which was, what, the 60s and 70s, in which sort of American science or developed world science was brought to developing nations, and new crop strains were introduced, and it produced enormous amounts of food in a hurry. And that was one reason why food production exceeded the rate of population growth. The problem is those yields are not increasing at the same rate as they were in the past. Maybe they will in the future when biotech gets really up and running, but right now they're not. And some people are wondering, at least in the strains of crops that we use today, the main strains that we use today, whether we've sort of maxed out the potential of some of these genetic strains. There are some folks who think we may be able to get human beings to live indefinitely, but most people think that if we lived 100 years, or push average longevity into the late 80s, as opposed to the low 70s right now, that the high or the mid 80s might be the most that we could get the human species on average to live. You understand that it's sort of maxing it out. Some folks are saying that may be true, at least of these the primary strains that form the monocultures, or the primary strains that we harvest most of our food from. Then a struggle to raise yields. I said the Green Revolution was the result of increased yields, but that these yields have dropped. So that's the point I was just trying to make. And then finally, there are a variety of environmental deductions. Some of these are more speculative, some of them are more clearly understood in terms of what the loss of an inch of topsoil will do in the long run to a decline in short and long-term yields. But I'll just put them up there without taking a lot of time to go through them. This is another World Watch graphic that just shows you areas of concern for soil degradation. You can see that quite a few of them are in this dark orange color, and quite a few of the rest are in sub-Saharan Africa and much of the United States. Soil degradation here being primarily through waterborne and wind-generated erosion, but also through soil compaction, through the use of heavy machinery, cattle grazing, etc. So put together, these kinds of environmental deductions are going to have a toll, whether just exactly how much of a toll, we don't know. Certainly global warming, if in fact it comes to pass, as many scientists believe it will, the question is to what degree, it's going to have an impact on a lot of things, but one of the things it's going to impact is climactic growing zones. Yes, it will be warmer in Iowa, and we could probably grow bananas, but it doesn't mean that we would be able to grow the same amount of corn and soybeans in Canada as we can right now in Iowa. Why? Because the soils in Canada...